shocking ouster at the top of the U.S. Navy. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening to First Coast Connect this morning. We're live from Studio 5. And just ahead on the show, the Navy Secretary forced out of his job. What does this mean for national security? We want your calls. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, activists in Jacksonville speak out against the early rollout of 5G. We'll tell you why. But first this morning, the Secretary of the Navy has apparently been forced out of his job over the handling of a case involving Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher. Gallagher was acquitted of killing an ISIS prisoner. On Sunday, Defense Secretary Mark Esper asked for Spencer's resignation, Navy Secretary Richard Spencer. Now, with our large Navy community here on the First Coast, we decided to start the show off today with a closer look as we welcome a national security and foreign policy expert. Nancy Soderberg is the former third-ranked Deputy National Security Advisor and Ambassador to the United Nations. She was the first woman deputy to serve in that role. Soderberg now directs the Public Service Leadership Program at UNF, and she joins us now with more about the news coming out of the Navy. Nancy Soderberg, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are your questions about the ousting of Navy Secretary Richard Spencer? We want to hear from Navy people, too. There's lots of you out there, so call us up. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaNJax. So what led up to the firing or the removal of Richard Spencer?
Well, first of all, you have to understand this didn't just happen overnight. The president has been intervening in military cases of justice. He's done it with the Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher. He's also pardoned Michael Brehenna, who was convicted of murdering a prisoner in Iraq in 2008. And while the president is the commander-in-chief, he has full legal authority to do so. Intervening in the military process of justice is highly disruptive to the military. What triggered this initial, the Secretary of the Navy was cautioning the White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, that he was not going to overturn a SEAL peer review of Gallagher. The president intervening in that hadn't directly ordered that that peer review not go forward. So as Secretary of the Navy, he wanted the normal process of the SEALs. And this is a peer review. It's a review of Navy SEALs of Gallagher's action. Now, Gallagher was someone who had shot civilians. He was turned in by his own Navy SEALs and was not convicted of murdering an individual, but rather posing with the dead corpse of the man he had murdered. And that's when the president stepped in. And this is highly unusual. And what happened over the weekend was the Secretary of the Navy was telling different things to the White House than he was telling his own chain of command. And when you're in that situation, he really had no choice but to fire him. But the really bigger issue is the president's interference in the military system of justice.
And can you explain why that is so extraordinary and so unusual?
Sure. I mean, I've worked in the U.S. government for decades, and the military has a very strict code of conduct. It has a very strict way of ordering its men and women to work within certain rules. And it's important for military discipline. Now, this is an issue where you have to remember what some of these individuals have done. They've essentially murdered civilians. And in the case of Gallagher, was turned on by his own SEAL, Navy SEAL peers, that they were horrified with what Gallagher was doing in acting outside of their own code of conduct, where you don't murder civilians, you don't shoot indiscriminately into crowds of civilians, both of which Eddie Gallagher did. And the process of justice was moving forward, and he was not convicted of shooting a prisoner. He did murder that prisoner, but then was not convicted of that. He was convicted of posing with the dead corpse. And the military internally was looking at whether they should push him out of the SEALs and revoke his Trident pin, which is one of the most coveted honors of a SEAL, is you get to wear that Trident pin, which symbolizes you're in what is the elite of the elite of our military. And that's where before that had been decided, there was a review plan. The president jumped in and said, no, I'm not going to allow that happen. We're going to protect Gallagher. And you have to remember, Gallagher's been all over Fox News, which is the president's main source of information, and stepped in. And the Secretary of the Navy said privately that he might resign rather than carry that order out. And he didn't tell his own Secretary of Defense that. And that's what got him caught in those crossfires that caused him to get fired over the weekend.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Published reports say that Secretary Spencer had apparently privately proposed to the White House that he would ensure that Gallagher retired as a Navy SEAL and kept his Trident insignia if they didn't interview with a review board that was determining his fitness to stay in the elite force. This contradicted his own public position on the case, the Pentagon says. So it seems as though Spencer was trying to adhere to military codes of conduct and at the same time appease or assuage or mollify the White House. And he was not able to do both. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, in his own statement, Spencer said, I no longer share the same understanding with the commander-in-chief who appointed me in regards to the key principle of good order and discipline. And once you're in that situation, you really have no choice but to leave.
What does this mean for national security? Because as you've observed, the military has strict codes of conduct for a reason. They're to ensure our safety and our reputation around the world.
Well, I think it's very disruptive. And, you know, what this interference has done is disrupt the SEAL code of conduct, disrupt the review process within the Pentagon, and cause the Secretary of the Navy to get fired. I mean, all of that is incredibly disruptive and disheartening. Now, the flip side of this is Gallagher put forward the narrative that he was the victim of vengeful SEAL commanders, and he had a legal team that included two of Trump's friends, also former partners of Giuliani, Bernie Kerik, who is a former police commissioner, and Mark McKasey, who's one of Trump's lawyers. And so there's a back channel here to the president that got his attention. Now, you have to remember, to our viewers, the president has the absolute legal authority to intervene in any military matter because he is the commander-in-chief. The question is this appropriate? Should he have sat on the sideline like every other president has done, is let the military code of conduct, the military system of justice, go forward without presidential interference?
Let's go to your calls as we speak with Ambassador Nancy Soderberg about the ousting of the Secretary of the Navy. What are your questions and thoughts? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Keith is in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say that Donald Trump's actions regarding Chief Gallagher are just totally reprehensible. The military leaders should follow the example of Admiral Elmo Zumwalt. In the 70s, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger ordered him to discharge some protesting minority sailors who were protesting racial discrimination. Nixon ordered them to be discharged with dishonorable discharges. Admiral Zumwalt ignored that order because it was immoral and illegal. What Donald Trump is doing should not be allowed. I know he's the commander-in-chief, but he is undermining military discipline, and that is trickling down all throughout the ranks.
Okay, thanks for that. What about that comment, given that, especially in our community, we have a large Navy presence? Thank you, Keith. How is this affecting morale amongst the rank and file, as he said?
I can't help. And I think what I teach at the University of North Florida. We have a lot of folks going into the military. I've had students who, you know, text me from their commissioning services. They're proud to be part of that service to our country, but they also want to know what the rules are. And if you're commanding these young men and women entering our service, you need to be in charge of putting out the rules and making sure that there are consequences if you don't follow them. And so this is a president that really is reaching pretty far down the ranks. Normally, a president would deal with the secretaries of the Navy or the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with many stars on their shoulders. I mean, I've not seen a president of the United States really deal with anybody who didn't have at least two stars on their shoulders. And so to undermine the process of justice, I think, is going to be a legacy of the president as disruptive. Instead of the commander-in-chief, he's the disruptor-in-chief and revels in it. He has the full right to do that. But the question is it wise? And I think in this case, it is undermining our own military.
549-2937. Jeff is on the South Side. Hi, Jeff. Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Good morning. A couple of things that Ambassador Sonnenberg left out. One, the Navy was accused of, one hesitates to say found guilty, but was accused of and did prosecutorial overreach. There was material uncovered by their investigators that would have supported Chief Gallagher's position. It was withheld from the defense, as both the UCMJ and the Supreme Court have ruled it must be provided. Second thing is that there was a late, now whether it was part of the same issue or not, but the medic who was working on, who was assisting the person who Gallagher had shot, testified that he had suffocated the individual and thereby killed him, not Gallagher.
Okay,
so
and
fact that came out in the court martial.
And how did you learn that, Jeff?
A variety of news sources. I follow several, and it's been a common statement throughout the thing. It's on the court record.
Cool. All right. Thanks for that, Jeff. Nancy.
Yeah, I think what came out in the trial is that another one of the SEALs stepped up and said that no, he was the one who suffocated this prisoner. And that's partly why the process of justice did not convict Gallagher for murder. So those facts did come out, and he was acquitted of murder. What he was convicted of is taking picture with the corpse. So I would say, Jeff, you're right on there. He wasn't convicted for murder because those facts did come out.
Cersei is in Riverside. Oh, wait, Cersei wants to talk about 5G. We'll go to you in a few minutes, Cersei. We're still talking about the Navy Secretary's ouster. 549-2937. Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom.
Ah, good morning. I just wanted to say that, to the extent that we follow the rules of war is because we expect reciprocal treatment when our service members are in similar position. We expect them to be protected by the rules that we adhere to. And also, I totally agree that it is very unusual for a president to delve this deep into the chain of command to individual service members. And it's probably not a good idea.
Thanks for that. We're getting some tweets and emails, Facebook comments. Here is one from Paula. What else can be expected from President Bone Spurs? He has no respect for the military. This is a travesty, she says. She's referring to the president's deferment from serving in Vietnam because he said he suffered from bone spurs. That was later proven to be not accurate. He apparently doctored that diagnosis or asked a doctor to write that diagnosis inaccurately. So what about that, though, Nancy Soderberg? The president has the support, we need to point out, of the majority of military members, despite the fact that he dodged the draft. And this has more to do with ideology and his stance on a lot of issues. But it's just something to make note of.
Well, other presidents have not served. Bill Clinton, for instance, didn't either. And I think that matters to some who feel everyone should serve, but I think ultimately, as commander-in-chief, you're judged on how you serve the military of which you command. And I just go back to the previous caller's comment about the risk that enabling our soldiers to commit war crimes without any kind of penalties does put our own soldiers at risk. For instance, when there was a big debate when President George Bush, during the war on after 9/11 on terrorism, said that we were no longer going to follow the Geneva Conventions. For those out there who don't follow the international law of war, we're basically conventions set up to protect prisoners of war after the world wars. And it was designed to make sure that any prisoner was fed and clothed and given adequate medical care and not subject to torture or abuse. And there were many that felt that by not following the Geneva Conventions, the United States was putting our own soldiers at risk. Now, I think we do a great job of protecting our own soldiers, making sure that they're not captured and are well taken care of by our own people. It does raise the question that if any of our prisoners are held, would they face a copycat scenario here that does put our soldiers at risk? So I think that is a real debate.
Here's a tweet from a listener. What does the Secretary of the Navy do? And how will this change or impact operations?
It's interesting. The history of the secretaries of the Navy, they used to be cabinet secretaries. And so they have a long history of direct reports to the president and direct reports to Congress. And those channels still exist. As you saw, this Secretary of the Navy was conversing directly with the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney. And so there's always a tension. I've seen it myself. And then in the mid-80s, they did a reorganization of the Pentagon to try and have a joint cooperative system. So you have the Joint Chiefs of Staff where they're run by one individual. The Joint Chiefs of Staff and every services is represented there, and the secretaries of the various services are no longer cabinet secretaries. But that tension still exists. But on the day-to-day level, the secretaries of the Navy and Air Force and Army are in charge of making sure that their personnel are taken care of. They run the disciplinary systems. They make sure that they have the adequate resources. They lobby on the Hill for new pieces of equipment that they need for the right kind of pay, medical care, soups to nuts. They're in charge of making sure that their men and women in uniform have what they need to fight and win wars.
Okay, one more tweet for you. This one is from Rebecca. I'd like to reiterate the point one of your callers made regarding how this looks on the international stage. If our enemies did the same to one of our service members, we would be outraged, and rightly so. Not punishing this person sends a message. As a former national deputy national security advisor, ambassador to the UN, your thoughts about how this plays internationally and how this affects our security and our standing globally?
I think it undermines it. When the United States is seen as undermining the rule of law, it hurts our leadership across the globe to enforce the rule of law. And again, I'll reiterate, the president has the full authority to do this. So it's not a question of whether he has the right to intervene in military justice. The question is it the right thing to do? And I have never seen in my decades of service a president intervene at this stages of justice in so many different cases. And I think you have to ask, you know, why these cases, why now, and how many of these is he going to intervene, and how will it affect morale of the commanders? If they say, this is unacceptable, I'm going to throw you in the brink if you do X, Y, and Z, you know, can they, excuse me, appeal to someone in the president's orbits or Fox News and undermine that? It's just an untenable situation. So I think in the end, the president should let the military justice play itself out and support the commanders, who have a very difficult job in enforcing discipline in the ranks.
Nancy Soderberg, thanks for sharing your insights.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Former Ambassador Nancy Soderberg, she directs UNF's Public Service Leadership Program. And in a moment, why local activists are speaking out against the early rollout of 5G in Jacksonville. Well, it's billed as a major positive for Jacksonville. Duval is one of just 12 selected cities around the country to be chosen for the early rollout of 5G. Now, 5G stands for fifth generation cellular wireless. The telecom giants say it'll mean quicker downloads, better network reliability, and faster access to information for everybody. This rollout is happening right now in our area, but this early 5G presence in Jacksonville is drawing some pushback. Some activists say they're concerned about the placement of towers and antennas. Right now, we welcome two of them. Jacksonville resident Raymer Rachels joins us in studio. Also with us, local attorney and business owner Scott Kennelly. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And what are your questions and thoughts about the early rollout of 5G in Jacksonville? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Raymer, let's begin with you. 5G is being billed as this technological breakthrough. There has been a lot of excitement about it, but not for everyone. Why are some residents speaking out against 5G in the city?
The legislation that is currently before the city council is largely taking away the objective design standards that the city council established in 2018. The legislation was drafted by Verizon attorneys, and it strikes many of the specific design objectives. And what we are trying to suggest now is that the city council retain as much local control as they can, and that the rollout does not create visual blight with installation of poles and antennas approximately every 100, 200 feet in downtown Jacksonville.
Scott Kennelly, is that the only concern people have that are speaking out about 5G, or are there others?
People in our group have a variety of concerns, but really our focus is trying to make sure that we roll out 5G in a thoughtful, aesthetic way that preserves property values and protects homes and businesses.
And what would that look like?
So currently, back in 2018, the city council spent a long time coming up with, as Raymer mentioned, objective design standards. That basically regulates how closely they can be to a sidewalk. So they can't block business facades. They can't impede your view from your home. The technology, as it currently exists, could be the size of a refrigerator, up to 28 cubic feet. And so we're just trying to make sure that that when it's rolled out in a way that conceals and camouflages the technology, so people can still have access, but so that it doesn't bring down property values.
Raymer, there are health concerns too that some hold about 5G. What are those?
Well, the 1996 Telecommunications Act specifically prohibits objections to the rollout of telecom infrastructure based on health concerns. So, Melissa, you're 100% correct. There are major health concerns associated with the rollout of 5G. There are appeals by over 200 scientists and from 40-something countries to the United Nations asking for a moratorium on it. Locally and domestically, because of the legislation that has been passed here, we don't have the ability to stop it unless it is overturned at the FCC level.
Not likely. So it looks like a 5G is just going to keep rolling out in Jacksonville, despite the concerns of some voters, correct?
So the FCC legislation has this mandate, which gets passed down to the states, which gets passed down to the local level. So the city council is required to be in compliance with the state statute. However, there are other municipalities around the state, Pensacola, Winter Park, Miami Beach, who have had pushback and have maintained some of the objective design standards and retaining local control.
Let's go to your calls. What are your questions about the 5G rollout in Jacksonville? It's 549-2937. Circe is in Riverside. Circe, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, how can concerned citizens throughout Jacksonville, a sprawling city, but how can we participate in stopping the current ordinances or participate in the process even of establishing what current and future design standards will be here?
Sure. Cersei, thanks for that. Let's go to our attorney here on the show right now, Scott Kennelly. You've been hearing from residents wondering how they can have their voice heard. What legal options are available here?
So the most important thing right now is expressing to your council members that you have concerns about Verizon's proposed legislation. As Raymer mentioned, Verizon's legislation is looking to strip the city's control over how it gets rolled out. It's not looking our group is not looking to stop the rollout. It's just making sure that the city retains the control. So if you call your council mm-hmm. people, you're certainly welcome to come down to meetings. There's actually a workshop that Councilman Becton is running today from 2 to 4 down at City Hall. There's many other meetings coming up. And the Facebook group that we have has updates as far as...
What's the name of the Facebook group?
The name of the group is called Stop 5G Jax, which is part of a national campaign called Stop 5G. But really what we're trying to do is make sure that it's done in a responsible, thoughtful way.
And why was Jacksonville one of the 12 cities chosen for this rollout? Do we know?
I would love to know the answer to that. I don't know. I'm guessing perhaps there was some kind of competition among cities, but I don't know.
Okay. Lots of calls on this. 549-2937. Javon is calling all the way from Tampa this morning. Javon, good morning.
Good morning. So 5G technology requires the antennas to be set up a lot closer and more frequent than compared to current technology, where you may have one antenna that serves several square miles. They're going to have to mount 5G antennas on city blocks, on the sides of buildings, to get the kind of blanket coverage that we have with 3 and 4G. Are there particular neighborhoods or parts of town that are being targeted for 5G right now that I guess maybe some that people should be more or less concerned about?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Where are the towers and antennas going? Do we know?
So the ordinances, there are two ordinances on the books right now. One is 2019-757, which is specific to the downtown area. And I don't know. There's a website called antennasearch.com, which is not the most user-friendly website, but it does allow you to put in a specific address and allow you to determine if there are any applications that have been filed for a certain area. One of the concerns with all of this is there is no requirement by the telecommunications companies to give notice to residents if they are getting ready to install a tower or an antenna.
Now, what you're saying is that telecom, if they decide, okay, we need to put this antenna right in your front yard and take down your beautiful old tree because it's in the way, technically they have the right to do that. Is that right, Scott?
Yes, that's correct. The current ordinance does have requirement that you comply with the tree ordinance in Jacksonville. It doesn't mean that they can't cut down the tree, but it means I believe that they have to give to the tree fund. And as Raymer was saying, the state statute prohibits cities from notifying any residents that the application has even been filed. And so the first time you would know that there's 5G coming to your yard would be when it's there.
When they roll up to do it. You're also saying that the FCC might push through a rule called OTARD, over-the-air reception device. Telecom companies would have the right to install an antenna directly on a house or a business.
That's correct.
That's not necessarily going to happen, but it might?
That's correct. Our current ordinance provides some protections for that. But again, Verizon's efforts in the second city council bill, which is 2019-770, is to strike all provisions relating to the control of where these facilities can be located.
Now, in addition to your concern about visual blight and health and safety issues, exposure to radiation, you're also worried about privacy issues. Can you explain why?
So the privacy issues were actually discussed in a presentation that David Sanger did at the World Affairs Council at the University of North Florida just a couple of weeks ago. And he, for those of you who don't know who he is, he's a 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner and national security correspondent for the New York Times. He cited the 5G rollout as the number one security risk for the U.S. As cyber terrorism. So The signal itself is not particularly reliable. It is very vulnerable to hacking. And so the privacy concerns sort of take it to the next level. Everybody is familiar with the experience of having some kind of conversation with somebody and mentioning, say, a trip to Hawaii, and then all of a sudden you've got an offer for plane tickets to Hawaii. And this is taking it to a much more frightening level.
Let's go to Teresa in Bay Meadows. Teresa, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was just going to say that I have seen these antennas being rolled out in the Bay Meadows Southside area.
Okay. How many of them?
I want to say I've seen about 4 on Bay Meadows and on a couple of the side streets. And then I live on Western Way, and I've seen at least one there.
Okay. So we know they're going up there then, Scott. And according to FCC rules, they can put them fairly close together. Isn't that right?
They can put them as close together as they think it would be required to make them effective. Currently, the technology, as one of the previous callers mentioned, is such that the towers themselves or the utility poles themselves have to be within 100 to 300 feet apart in order for this to be effective. So much, much closer than
what we're used to.
4G LTE technology.
Okay. Melanie in Avondale. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Do we have any type of urgency ordinance like, say, Mill Valley, California did when they blocked deployment of the 5G towers? Immediately, they took action at a city level, and they took into effect regulations affecting the health and safety of the residents. Do we have anything like that?
Thanks for that. Okay, so some cities have stopped this rollout, it sounds like, Scott.
That's correct. Some cities in other parts of the country have put a moratorium on this. The state statute that was passed in July actually prohibits cities from putting any kind of moratorium or slowdown on the technology. It does provide, however, them to control some limited objective design standards. And so that's our focus. Unfortunately, we cannot put a moratorium on it. That said, Pensacola's mayor is suing the state. The League of Cities is also suing.
They're getting the rollout, Pensacola?
Pensacola is also getting some 5G technology, and so they're they're pushing back. Our group is really focused on what's before the city council right now, which is Verizon's efforts to strip all city control.
And as you mentioned, there will be a meeting at City Hall today. Councilman Danny Becton is looking at this issue today at council chambers at 2 o'clock. Correct?
That's correct. And the reason why it's Councilman Becton, he's chairman of the Land Use and Zoning Committee, which is currently where both bills are. One of the bills is actually before two other committees, but Councilman Becton is kind of running point currently.
So let folks know, let your council person know, or LUS Chairman Danny Becton know where you stand on 5G. And we thank you for sharing all this information with us. Raymer Rachels and Scott Kennelly, both with the Stop 5G Jacks group, which you can find on Facebook. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, a local company brews up 3 generations of success. Don't go away. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
Together, we host the Florida Roundup, a weekly live statewide call-in show looking at the biggest issues impacting the Sunshine State. If it's making news in Florida, you'll hear it on the Florida Roundup. So join us each Friday at noon, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
Welcome back. Well, it's a family-owned business that's been in this area for generations, and they continue to brew up happy customers and continued growth. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jack's Daily Record speaks with Ben Johnson, president of Martin Coffee Company.
Martin Coffee Company is a family-owned venture that started almost 85 years ago in the wake of the Great Depression. 19-year-old Fred Martin borrowed money from a family friend to move from Brandon north to Jacksonville for a job, selling coffee for 25 cents a pound. It paid $10 a week, but paid off in the long run for his family. He and his wife Amy opened the Martin Coffee Company roasting plant in downtown Jacksonville in 1957. Today, it is Jacksonville's oldest specialty coffee roaster and remains family-owned and operated. Ben Johnson is the third generation and president. Ben, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen. It's great to be here this morning.
How does a family business survive into a third generation? Some statistics show that just 13% of businesses are passed successfully to a third generation.
Well, it's a great question because I definitely see why only 13% pass for three generations. It's definitely a lot of work, but it's not easy, but I'm definitely very fortunate in my family business for a couple reasons, I guess. My grandparents instilled very strong business values and a very strong business foundation when, they grew up during the Depression and worked hard, so they appreciated the value of a dollar. And so they've always believed that, you know, you should, you know, never borrow more than you can, never borrow money, actually. So we were a debt-free company, and so they never borrowed a dime. And so when I came on board, our business was very financially stable. And also, the really big kicker in a family business, I think, to make it so successful is that we all just get along. I was able to work for about 10 years with my grandmother. My grandfather had passed away before I started the business, but was able to work with her and also my father. And I think we just have a lot of trust and respect and confidence in each other. And so they let me do, you know, basically what I wanted to do and without a whole lot of family drama.
Do you have a lot of family members in the business?
Well, my dad still comes in part-time, and my sister, she came on board about 8 years ago as our office manager, and she's great. So we work really, really well together. And so, it's awesome to have her there in the office.
Well, your mother's the second generation, and at what point did you know you were going to be in this business?
Well, I never really planned on it when I was younger. My parents never put any pressure on me in the business. I've always loved entrepreneurship and small business. I was even involved with like the president of FBLA in high school. And I started my own little coffee business when I was in high school for a couple of years, where I would buy coffee from my grandparents and flavor it and sell it at a little antique mall on Beach Boulevard. And it actually grew pretty well. So I had a good little business to sell before I went off to college. And then after college, I came back for a summer, and unexpectedly, one of our salesmen had passed away, so I just filled in temporarily as a route driver, and I never left.
So you've done everything with the company.
Yeah, my first couple years, or 3 or 4 years, I was a route driver, and then unexpectedly again, all of our salesmen have been with us for 25 to 35, 40 years, and it sounds weird to say, but they've all typically have found jobs part-time working with the business, and at that time, after I was a route driver, one of our sales our service manager, he had passed away. So I went and worked in the service department. And then after that for a couple of years, then I worked as roasting and packing. And then basically wore all the hats in the business.
Well, describe the company. It's a small business. Is it a craft coffee brewery? Who's your customer base? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we definitely are a small business. We've been very lucky to grow over the years. And we have, a little over 400 customers in the area. And they range from restaurants, hotels, offices, coffee shops, and cafes. It was kind of pretty funny. Like when the coffee business has evolved so much in the last 20 years. When I started on board, we had just two coffees, regular Martin and decaffeinated Martin. And that satisfied 99.9% of the palates of Jacksonville. So over the years, people have become more knowledgeable and their flavor profiles and their palates have definitely become a little bit more diverse. And so we have became more diverse as well. So now we have about 16 different coffees from 16 different countries. And so we not only bring those in, we also blend several of those to create many more different blends. So I like to say if going from two coffees to probably 20 different ranges of coffees, we can satisfy just about every palate there is for a coffee drinker.
Now, do you still have customers from your grandparents' day?
Well, that question I get a lot. Unfortunately, we do. I mean, we do have some, and I'll mention them. But first of all, it's very hard to find restaurants that have been around for 62 years in Jacksonville. And luckily, one of the oldest restaurants is a barbecue shop, the Pig Barbecue. And they've been around since we started, and their family are their three generations as well. One of our old customers, too, that was very well known in Santa Maria and St. Augustine. So they were a long original customer in St. Augustine area. Hopefully they'll get back up and going, and we will continue serving them there. We've got a lot of customers we've served for 50 years and all that. And one of my favorite longtime stories is Dennis Chan with Blue Bamboo. His grandfather bought from Martin Coffee for my grandfather. His uncles have bought from us for years at all their Chinese restaurants. And so it's fun. We've become good friends, and it's fun to carry on our legacy together.
Now, I know that, you know, there's a lot of competition, of course, within the coffee industry today. Can you talk about your sales growth, your growth rate, and what your annual sales are? I know you're privately held.
Yep. Well, I would say we're shy over a little over $1 million. We try to always do about a few percent every year. One of the things of our business is being a debt-free business. We love the fact that we can sleep at night. We know how much money's in the bank. We know, so we grow slowly, consistently, and that has helped us be competitive. Not only, we can sleep at night, but also we can give, good pricing for our customers, and we know where we stand. But we're always, one of the things that we're always growing is we're evolving with the business. So, that, like I said, with adding the new coffees, we used to have about 40 products we sold in total, including teas. Now we have well over 600 UPC, SKUs that we carry, ranging from syrups, smoothie mixes, frap mixes, and then a whole line of cappuccino machines, espresso machines, and all of that. So we're growing significantly when it comes to product lines and diversity on equipment and products.
Well, Ben Johnson, president of Martin Coffee Company, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Karen. Check out Karen's work every day in the Jack's Daily Record. A quick break, but in a moment, as fans call for the return of Minshew. Yes, were you one of them? Culpepper steps up next to talk about the Jaguars' woes. Ooh, that's after this.
Full of copper matte plates made by the British in 1780 and lost until the 1940s finally make their way back to the FHS collections. Coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Dr. James Cusick about these exciting artifacts. We'll discuss the Rockledge Resort District, and we'll learn about early pottery in Florida. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
You're on a car show in the biggest car buying part of the country. How do you prepare?
I'm looking for trends and competitive edge. I'm not going to auto shows.
Oh. I'm Kai Rizdal. How tech and the way mobility works now is changing the car show game. That's next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. On the next Fresh Air, college in a maximum security prison.
Unlike other schools, it has bars. It has gates that close and open. It has doors that must be locked.
The PBS documentary series College Behind Bars tells the moving story of prisoners taking rigorous courses and earning degrees while serving their time. We'll speak with director Lynn Novick and two graduates of the program. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Is it time for a wealth tax?
I'm tired of freeloading billionaires.
It's Bo. It's complete Bo. She's screwing around with the wrong guy. I just have a problem with vilifying the wealthy. They should be treated like everybody else.
What do billionaires owe the country? And who gets to decide? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Welcome back. Well, it's another low point for the Jaguars as Jacksonville loses in Nashville yet again.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Okay, Culpepper is here to break down the depressing details for us. And you know, Cole, on Sunday, you saw what one of the top trending topics was. Did you see it?
I must have missed it.
One word, Minshew.
Yeah, listen, the quarterback didn't play well, Nick Foles. We are so wrapped up in the quarterback. People, let me just tell you this. It doesn't matter who's at quarterback when you give up 200 yards rushing to the other team. And it's now happened three straight weeks. Something is very, very broken with the Jaguars defense. They don't have the play. They're getting pushed around. They're getting shoved all over the field by three consecutive teams in the AFC South. First Houston in the game in London, then 2 weeks later in Indianapolis, and then this past game yesterday in Tennessee. They're just getting manhandled.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter who the quarterback is, folks. And let me just say this. We've seen the Jaguars play fairly well for a while in each of the last three games. It was close at halftime in a low-scoring game. Yesterday they trailed 7-3. And then in the third quarter, we've seen teams make better adjustments. Teams play better. Jaguars not make tackles. I definitely think that there's something going on here in terms of how Nick Foles has played. It doesn't look like he's right to me. You can put Gardner Minshew in if you want. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Right now, you've got to figure out whether Nick Foles can be your quarterback next year. And or you're going to have a quarterback competition. And I think it's pretty unanimous around the city. That was it yesterday.
Foles.
For the team. It ended the season. They cannot make the playoffs. Now, mathematically, they're not out yet. But practically speaking, they're not making the playoffs.
So what's the fallout?
Well, I think this is likely going to lead to major changes with the coaching staff on the roster and in the front office for this offseason. I don't know if Shad Khan's going to make the changes right away. I don't think it's going to be probably for the next couple of weeks because I don't think it makes much sense to be cleaning house right now. If you're going to fire one guy and, you know, elevate somebody to an interim head coach, the Jaguars have a couple of guys who've been head coaches in the NFL on the staff before. They could potentially do that. But if you're going to clean house, if you're going to swab the decks, you can't do it all at once during the season. It's just not practical in the National Football League. I do think, though, we will see a quarterback competition next season as well. And honestly, it's just unfortunate that the Jaguars fan base will be watching other teams playing the playoffs for the 11th time in the last 12 years.
I mean, you and I both know people that have gone to every home game since the beginning of the franchise. So there are some loyal fans out there.
There are, and way more than probably the performance on the field has deserved. And that, you know, again, 2017, they went to the AFC Championship game. That looks like an anomaly right now. It's the only year since 2007 they've been in the postseason. And the comments from Shad Khan a couple of weeks ago, that Northeast Florida didn't have the appetite for 8 home games, honestly sounds even more hollow now that his team can't stay in contention after Thanksgiving.
If the team wins, the fans will be there.
We saw it at the end of 2017 when they started playing well, went to the playoffs. It was a madhouse. Mm-hmm. 2018, all kinds of hope. Things were crazy. Think back to the game against the Patriots when the Jaguars beat the Patriots and sort of exercised a few of the demons from that AFC Championship game. The fan base is not the problem. It's the organization that's the problem. And they don't have enough good players. I'm not saying that these guys have forgotten how to coach because we've seen them be, you know, coach effectively before, but things change.
And I think you're going to see major changes with this team sometime shortly after Christmas.
Wow. Okay. Pretty depressing. Meanwhile, the Jaguars are at home Sunday for the first time in 5 weeks. How's it looking as they face off against Tampa Bay?
It's just looking super. You know, Tampa Bay is not particularly good, but right now, I don't know how anybody could pick the Jaguars to win based on what they've not done, which is stop the other team.
Yeah, they've got to be pretty demoralized. Okay, let's continue with a little more football talk. It is Florida State Week.
It is Saturday in Gainesville. The Gators and Seminoles will face off. Wasn't that long ago that both teams came into this game both ranked in 2015 and in 2016. Both schools were in the top 15. This year, the Gators are number 8. The Noles not anywhere near the top of the polls. Last year, the Gators blew out the Seminoles in Tallahassee, but the Gators haven't beaten the Seminoles in the Swamp, amazingly, since 2009. Florida does lead the overall series, but this is going to be something for the Gators. They're trying to win their have their second straight 10-win season under Dan Mullen. The Noles have not lost a game under Odell Higgins as interim head coach in two stints, so we'll see how it all plays out. I suspect Florida will win this one pretty handily. They kick it off at 7:30 Saturday night.
Okay, Georgia winning Saturday over Texas A&M. And then last but not least, Cole says only two high school football teams in our area still in the playoffs.
Yeah, Bowles and University Christian are still alive. They both play in a state semifinals matchups on Friday. Bowles hosts Coco, while UC goes to Victory Christian in Lakeland. Both schools one win away from the state championship game.
Good luck to him. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Catch him every Monday on this show and every night on Channel 4. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, that is our show. Thanks so much for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is our director today. The station news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with First Coast Connect. Tomorrow, make sure to tune in as North Florida Congressman Al Lawson drops by Studio 5 again to talk impeachment and other news. That's tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.